Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to the GoTo Book Club. My name is Erik Wilde and I have the great joy today to present to you this wonderful book, Unbundling the Enterprise. I have the two authors here with me. I was really happy. So I read the book. I loved it. And I proposed to GoTo and said, hey, we really should do an interview in the book club on this book. So I'm really glad that we did this. And thanks so much, Matt and Steve, for joining. And maybe you can just introduce yourselves very briefly so that people get to know you a little bit before we start talking about the book. Matt, maybe you can get started.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks, Erik, for going to GoTo and recommending the book. We really appreciate that. And we're very thankful for this opportunity. So my name is Matt McLarty. I'm the CTO of Boomi and obviously the co-author of Unbundling the Enterprise. APIs, optionality, and the science of happy accidents. Throw in the subtitle in there because I'm sure we'll be talking about a lot of those things. But I'm based in Vancouver, BC, Canada, and it's just great to be here. Steven.
Just like Matt, thank you, Erik. Really wonderful opportunity to discuss the book and really pleased to be here. Thank you for making this happen. My name is Steven Fishman. I'm the field CTO for Boomi. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. Matt and I have been working on this for a couple of years and we're really excited about it. Wonderful to be here today.
Yeah, and maybe I complete things then by saying I'm in Zurich, Switzerland, so I'm joining from a different continent. Again, my name is Erik Wilde. I work for InnoQ as a principal consultant, and I deal with these things all the time, so it was great to read a book that looks a little bit at the API as kind of an enabling factor in a really big way. And I mean, as you already point out in the subtitle, it's about happy accidents. It's about making sure that you embrace multiple options that you have. So could you maybe start by just talking a little bit about the motivation for the book and why uncertainty? I mean, it sounds a little bit maybe not quite intuitive, but why uncertainty is such an important thing to embrace when you think about businesses and how to succeed as a business nowadays.
All right, I'll start with that. So Matt and I, we did have an inspiration to write a book about APIs, and very quickly it became a book about APIs and optionality, as optionality being a significant part of the value that's yielded through the approach. But we did not necessarily set out to write a book about uncertainty and happy accidents. That found us. But one of the things that Matt was very insistent on at the beginning, which I'm very grateful that I listened to, was we didn't want to like pontificate based upon our past experience and have it just be, you know, this is what we think. Instead, we went like a different direction of interviewing like more than a dozen of, you know, maybe closer to 20 different CIOs and execs from around the world. And hearing them really informed the direction we went, because one after the other said the exact same thing. Like, but yeah, they might have used slightly different words, but it was, we didn't plan on this. We had this architectural approach and this other thing happened. The future found us every time, whether it was, you know, talking with the people at Google, talking with the people at Slack, talking with the people at Coca-Cola, at Best Buy, and over and over and over again, every single one. But nobody clarified that as that was their goal. It just kind of happened. And that is what happened, honestly, with the book. That concept found us through the interview process, and it became this organizing theme throughout of that instead of preparing for one future, prepare for any future, and that future will find you. And you know, asymmetric value return will come because of the nature of how the market changes. Like there's a deep cut in the book that speaks to the work of Carlos Baldwin out of Harvard. Real, you know, deep, you know, super nerds well, might have heard of the book Design Rules. But Carlos says option value is high when consumer tastes are heterogeneous and unpredictable. And it plays out exactly that way because the world changes very often and people change what they like very often. And no two people really, you know, fully gravitate towards the same thing. And that's also true of enterprises. So because the way the world is, conserving your options and creating your options will lead to asymmetric value opportunity in the future. You just have to be ready to exploit it when it comes.
Yeah, and you came up with this wonderful oops process, which is, or I was not quite sure whether this is OOOps, but that would be object oriented, so that's not good. So let's call it oops.
Definitely oops.
But you came up. Yeah, I know. But you came up with this idea of how optionality, after you embrace it, then how to actually also make it work, right? Because just creating options is, as the wonderful phrase in logic says, it's necessary but not sufficient. So the idea then would be that this oops process actually gets you to the point where it's not just like you exploring options, but also you being ready to capture on them and capitalize on them and make sure you make the most out of them. So Matt, maybe you could talk us a little bit through this process, what it's for and what the different stages look like.
Yeah, it's branding is always good, right? We had sort of the epiphany around happy accidents. I remember we were, you know, talking about, we were looking up pictures of Bob Ross. We had all sorts of Bob Ross graphics in it for happy accidents early on. And then I think oops came about because we were just trying to, essentially what Steven said, bang on, we really wanted to discover, like, if APIs are the tip of the iceberg, what's the iceberg? And so, you know, optionality was a big part of it. We really went through those stories. And as he said, it's not like those companies were using a science of happy accidents, right? It was more like they, because they created the options, they had these different places where things happened serendipitously. So I think part of our ambition then became, well, what if you were aiming for happy accidents? What if it just wasn't serendipity that was happening? Could you come up with a methodology around engineering those happy accidents? And that's where the oops came from. So optionality obviously is the first ingredient, but optionality isn't enough on its own. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really, you know, again, we sort of take these APIs for granted, those of us who've worked in the space for a long time. When you sort of try and step out of that frame and look at things with fresh eyes, what is it about APIs? Well, they're decontextualized business capabilities, right? And that was a lot of what we were focusing on is how do you decontextualize things? It's the fact that they can be decontextualized and then recontextualized in different ways that makes them so valuable. And so what digital business gives us, I think, is if you take the technology away and just think of it from a business perspective, is it really just removes a whole lot of friction. A lot of the historical friction you'd have in business around cost of moving things, cost of logistics, cost of communication, all that, because that just goes closer to zero as things become more and more digitized. When you decontextualize the business capabilities, then you've got all this ability to assemble these complex networks of capabilities. And so that's where the value network stuff came in to look at, you know, when we think about business models, if you think about how companies come up with new business lines, new profit schemes, or even just formulate new companies from scratch, it really comes down to the business model. And digital business allows us to come up with more and more complex business models. And the way you do that is through these value exchanges, where it's not like, you know, the early 20th century where Ford had a competitive advantage because they would just buy up their entire supply chain end to end. Now you can break things down into much more granular capabilities and focus on the things you're really good at and then assemble a bunch of commoditized services from other companies. So opportunism through value dynamics is really about that property of these digital business capabilities being decontextualized. So that's like, okay, now we have a way of looking at the landscape of opportunities and thinking about how we can exercise the options that we have. And then the optimization through the feedback loops piece is really, again, digital business gives us the ability to instrument things very cheaply and widely. So now we can get much more current feedback on how things are performing. We can adjust course as quickly as possible. So, you know, one of the other analogies, we were consciously trying to put in memorable analogies and things and terms, as is probably obvious now, but we use this pirate analogy throughout, right? Where we talk about instead of thinking about business as you get a treasure map and you have one place where you can dig for treasure and you've got to have an expensive crew and all this, it's more like optionality. It means that there's probably treasure all over the place. The opportunism and through value dynamics means you might not know where X is on the map, but you want to find the right island or set of islands to go to. And then the feedback loops is kind of, you know, thousands of robotic pirates digging all at once. So, and getting the feedback in real time. So I think that the OOPS methodology is theory around being intentional about finding happy accidents, but it's all based on those experiences that we heard from the people that we interviewed and the research that we did.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I found fascinating was that, like you said, of course, in the digital space, I think a lot of the value equations just look very different. Things scale differently and so forth. So this kind of skews things in a certain direction. But on the other hand, and I don't know whether it's in the book or it was some talk that I watched you doing somewhere. I do remember the 3D printed pirates. So that's really hard to do, right? So what I'm wondering is now, if you are not specifically in the digital place, I mean, you also have some interesting case studies where it still makes sense. I mean, you have to be a little bit more, I would probably say, careful about the cost structure of the options, right? And what it takes. But it's not just a digital thing. I mean, it's a general kind of business strategy that I guess, depending on the market you're in, might even make sense if you take digital out of the picture. Is there something that you would like to share with in terms of like how this might apply to even not entirely digital scenarios, Stephen?
Sure. Well, one thing you'll notice, like the first half of the book is very dedicated to like unpacking what this science is. How does the math work? How does the economics work? How do the three different, you know, parts of the OOPS methodology interact with each other to yield this thing? The second half of the book is all about the case studies. And in the case studies, you'll notice that more than 50%, it's more like 80%, are not like digital giants or digital companies to begin with, whether it was, you know, like the ones we previously talked about, like Coca-Cola, Lowe's, Best Buy, Cox Automotive, which is a weird hybrid of both digital and physical. And the examples there are so interesting in terms of how they arrived at this place. And while I 100% agree with you that, you know, instrumenting feedback loops in a non-digital world is harder than in a digital world, there's it's like the Coca-Cola example from the freestyle machines is amazing. Like that is, you know, the freestyle machines where you can go and you program your own flavor, get your drink as you want it. And they would actually send that information back to Coke to find this flavor could sell if we package that flavor. And like, it's just a great example of organizations can do pretty much anything if they're focused on it and they have, you know, enough commitment in there of, you know, who would have thought 10, you know, 15, 20 years ago that you could really create that sense and respond movement with really rapid turnaround times from your soda fountain? Or why would you want to do that? And now it's like the no brainer because you're looking at it in reverse and seeing that they did it that way. And so if you look at the studies, like a lot of them focus on that idea of not that the, you know, and this is part of like, it comes back to something Matt was talking about a second ago, how the methodologies work together, is that the APIs in and of themselves are necessary because it not only decontextualizes and does all that other stuff, it pulls your ability to get the value out of that capability right up close to the surface. And because it is close to the surface and easy to combine, access, you know, pull out as an isolated thing because it is isolated by definition, like because it is that way, the cost to experiment with it is by definition lower than if it were already inside the monolith and you had to pull it out. Because it is by its own nature lower to combine and recombine and do other things with it, that by and of itself, without you having to do anything else, brings your cost to experiment down. And then if you do the four of the things that the book lays out, which are, you know, ramps, statistical nuance inside your team, feature flags, and I'd have to pull the fourth out of the book, and having the right tools for that team of visualizations. If you have those four, you can not only bring the treasure closer up to the surface, but create the conditions with your team and your tools to make it rapidly easy to find the winners. And that's like one of the points that's inside the, like in the first half of the book, where it speaks about a serial optionality and convex tinkering from Nassim Nicholas Taleb. And, you know, he laid it out and it's right. And because you could see from the case studies, so many of those case studies were, they didn't hit $1 billion just through one innovation. They found a winning option and they doubled down. You know, AWS is amongst the best examples of that, you know, anywhere. And I think probably all your listeners probably know what that is. But remember, they didn't get to $100 billion in revenue in a day or a year. They got there over 20 years by, you know, building the first three, seeing that that was working, and then both at the same time, adding new things and keeping cost to experiment low. And that uses all the three parts of the methodologies. Decomposition by default, that's the Bezos mandate. At the same time, it's making things both internally and externally available. They didn't have to make them externally available. They had to be possible. That kept the treasure close to the surface. They would always look at the map and see what the opportunities are. And they had a relentless focus on keeping the cost to experiment low. And those three things in combination will run you up that convex optional curve. And you'll find these enormous wins.
So one of the things I keep seeing, and I find this really fascinating, you know, as like a recurring theme, is that, I mean, I totally buy into everything that you're saying. And I love the book. But then you also see quite a number of organizations, I would say, who are a little bit not quite as visionary, right? And may not see that as such an obvious thing to do, you know, keep your options open and so forth. And for them, sometimes, or actually oftentimes, from what I can see, like keeping this machinery up that allows you to exercise these options seems like unnecessary cost, right? For them, it's like, oh, why do we have this stuff? We're not need, it's not driving revenue right now, right? And like, would you have any kind of recommendation, like on how, you know, how to change that mindset a little bit, or how to make it easier for organizations to embrace this kind of as, it's basically an investment into the future, right? But the question then is, well, are you, you know, how much do you want to invest, and then how much money do you have, right? So I think that's the really interesting part there. And I'm just wondering if there is anything you can share in terms of this trend sometimes, you know, to focus too much on cost and not enough on the opportunity that I'm kind of buying with that cost.
Yeah, we've probably lived through many examples of this. I think a lot of times it's pressure from finance or whatever, or perceived pressure from project managers. Like if you break it down into where the decisions get made and where the options get snuffed out, right? A lot of times it's in the name of finance. It's in the, yep. You know, if we take the time to build it in a way that drives up optionality, we're spending too much money and we need to get to this predictable outcome, right? So the interesting thing, I mean, it depends who you're talking to, but if you're talking to finance people, I think it's pretty interesting that this whole notion of optionality and measuring options, option value came out of the world of finance, right? So Carlos Baldwin, who Stephen mentioned earlier, she started her career focusing on economics and studying option value in financial markets, and had the moment of saying, you know, where else could this option value be applied, and start to study the tech world of technology, and found this phenomenon in the technical world and software that the ability to drive up option value is humongous in this space. So I think it's like, you know, I would start by just discussing the notion of option value. Like, on all the business cases that are being done out there, is anybody measuring option value? Is anybody saying, like, here's an estimate of the option value that we've got? Because that is a very financial concept. It's like saying, and okay. I think that's where the analogies can help. Like, and using examples. Like, I remember I worked at a bank for many years, and this is sort of pre-web APIs, but it was very much in the idea of building optional components and software. We had a huge project where they did they created a online account open process. This is going way back here, like when online banking was a new thing. So it was like, oh, well, you know what? We should allow customers to open accounts online from the web. Like, wouldn't that be awesome? And, you know, the bank hired a big third-party consultancy. They came in, they built this big monolithic blob on the side that did this online account open. And the results were like, hey, this is great. Now we want to use it to revamp our branch account open process. And it was like, okay, let's start from scratch, because we couldn't harvest any of the software assets that were there. So I think every company is riddled with the projects that were over time, over budget, you know, all that stuff. And they end up with a monolithic result. Like, so there's probably a lot of ways you have to attack it. Really introduce the concept of option value. You know, ask your financial people, how are you measuring option value? Where is option value in the business case? Because this is definitely one of those things. Eric, you probably remember when we were doing our sort of API 360 methodology, we're talking about APIs are just as much about what they enable as what they deliver day one. And that was really sort of another way of describing optionality. So, but putting in financial terms, saying there is real option value, we have case studies that show it, how are you measuring option value, could be a start. And I know, Stephen, you know, the work that we did with Cox Automotive, you know, talking about the new math, I think is a good example there.
But they seem to be, I mean, the Cox story is great, right? But they seem to be very strategic on that, right? For them, it was clear that they needed to kind of invest into this kind of optionality. But I really like this idea with the optionality. I will keep that in mind, because it does always fascinate me a little bit that, at least in a lot of organizations, it seems that there's much less fear to just spend huge amounts of opportunity cost, right? Because that you can never really kind of put a label on that, right? It's like, well, probably we didn't make all the money we could, but who knows what we could have made, right? And then there's this huge focus on cost, because that's, you can count very easily. And I think that's kind of an imbalance. So having something like the option value, actually, that would be a cool thing to just throw into the mix, I think, because it seems to me that a lot of companies might not have that in their math. Right? That's something that maybe is something they could really use.
So one nuance I think I'd like to add here is that, and Matt and I, we cover this every time in so many different conversations. The book doesn't say build APIs and decompose everything everywhere. It doesn't say that. It says decompose by default. And what that really means is shift the default in the funding conversation from, you have to prove the value of that decontextualized approach versus, like, instead of that, you have to prove the value of me not doing it that way, because you, by definition, you're killing the option value by doing it. And we're not even talking about you have to build all these capabilities. It's because these are processes and things that people are going to be building anyway. And if they are building them, it's one extra step. And once you get decent at it and your teams actually know how to do it, there is no additional marginal cost. In fact, marginal cost will go down over time. Like, the finance argument is the right argument. And if you actually unpack it to what is the marginal difference in this particular case, what is the option value that you're killing or not, the default conversation needs to be one. They need to prove that, hey, that this shortcut will actually be beneficial for us. That's the opposite of optional by default, is shortcut by default. And that's the thing that ends up in, you know, the big balloon payments of tech debt that so many organizations are struggling with right now. Optionality is the opposing force to technical debt. And like, we can show it, and it's real.
I really like that phrase you just used, Steve. It's like, you're killing option value. I think that's a phrase that I will start using. I like that. That's great. But let's dig a little deeper, because I'm really curious what you think about that. So one of the things that you're saying is that APIs are kind of the enabling thing for optionality at a technical level, let's say, because they are these, what did you say? Decontextualized business capabilities, right? That's what you said? Yeah. Very nice. I love that. But now, how do you create the good ones, right? That's also a conversation I think that all of us have had very often, right? What's a good API, and not on the technical level, right? But like, what are the useful APIs basically that would drive this kind of option value really? How do we find those? Because clearly, some probably are not as good as others, I would say. And then what would be kind of the process to end up with those that actually are the big drivers of that option value?
This is a great question, which I'll share a brief answer, then I'd like to hear Stephen's take on this as well. But I, you know, in the context of the book, I would say we've said for a long time, right? API should be products. API should be business aligned. I think, to put it in a more practical way, this is where I think the value dynamics approach of mapping out value exchange really helps, because it, you know, we don't have the visual aids here, but value dynamics is really about creating these visual maps of value networks, which are showing how you deliver value from your organization out to your customers ultimately. And that can be through indirect means, and you might have services from suppliers and partners and so on. So you end up with this map of all these either capabilities inside your organization or services outside. And then it becomes a matter of like the sort of nodes and edges in a graph of saying, you know, any place where value is exchanged is a good opportunity for a very business. Oh, there we go. There's the visual aid. a business API is really the points of exchange there. So I think that's, we offer a visual way of sort of seeing, surfacing where some good APIs might be.
So you drive it from, sorry, Stephen, I would like to hear more from you also, but so you would drive it from kind of that visual representation of how value is getting moved around, and then basically see, do I have APIs serving all these functions, or is there something in there where I basically cannot really explain how that happens in the current environment that I have?
One of the best examples of how the value, like the value mapping really plays out, the Cox example is great, because it's not just, do I have APIs or not? It's closer to how are we exchanging value today in either physical or digital realms, and how might we add additional value that we're not considering today, whether it's through, you know, adding in it like a data feed API for informatics for thing X or thing Y that your organization is trying to do. Like there's, you know, I do a lot of, you know, consulting and engagement with a lot of organizations on digital product and how to create new lines of revenue. And they, a lot of times they talk about cannibalization. You know, if I offer X here, will I kill Y revenue there and through cannibalized revenue? But accretive revenue is just as plausible, and that's in your control. That a lot of value dynamics stuff leads to a packaging question of how do I want to package value, and what's inside that package? And that can include all the physical forms of value delivered today, all the digital forms of value delivered today. And then additionally, more decontextualized data and other tools that people can use on the outside of the value consumer to find other ways to achieve value and higher levels of performance for the things that they're trying to do with your capabilities and data. The mapping gives that very visual way to point between two constituents or three constituents inside of a value network and say, hey, wouldn't this party benefit by having this one more or two more pieces of digital information? Could we be the right provider of that benefit? What would it take to make them pay for it?
Mm-hmm. And that I would assume that still is a little bit of identifying opportunities and maybe acting on it. One thing I would also like to talk a little bit about before we have to wrap it up at some point, I'm afraid. But one thing I also would like to talk about a little bit is the optimization phase, right? So, I mean, one of the things is this idea of optionality, creating all these options and then identifying opportunities in that set of options that you have created. And then you also have this thing where you say, and now you need to be good at optimizing things. How does that look in practice? Like, how have you seen this optimization being also one, I would say, necessary ingredient if you really want to make this whole model succeed?
So I'm looking up. There's the picture that's inside the book that talks about the four methods. And like, these are not ones that we invented. These are ones that came both out of the interviews and out of research and just being, you know, keeping up with things from having to do our jobs is the, you know, and Etsy did a great, amazing job at being able to show people how to do this type of stuff with ramps, feature flags, visualization tools, and statistically literate teams, that by having those four things, like we were talking about a minute ago, APIs bring value closer to the surface, easier to experiment with. But if you don't have your ability to do like A/B in wide ranges of multivariate testing, you're not going to be able to keep get like the velocity of number of experiments to actually make the whole thing work. That you know, the phrase is small bets place wide. In order to support 1,000 bets like at one point in time, you're going to have those opportunities really close to the surface. Individual experiments are cheap. You're also going to have the ability to read the results from them in comparison to other options, such that you can find the one that has the highest margin of value for you, which not only means that combination, but also the rapid ability to see that in a visual form with the statistical tooling to help you understand what it really means and what it doesn't. And then the smart people who can actually internalize what the metrics are really saying so that you can define what the right course is. Because, you know, statistics are nasty and dirty and that they can prove almost anything you want them to prove, but you need not only the visual to be able to see it and not have to do all the synthesis yourself, but you actually have to have the critical thinking skills and the statistical knowledge skills to really know what they mean, know when things are like reverting to mean, know when things are, you know, the sample size is too small, know when things are hitting the right point that for statistical significance. That's a human job. At least it still is.
If I can just sort of segue from that into, I know we're going to be closing soon. So just a point to kind of wrap all this together. We published the book on IT Revolution, which is, you know, Gene Kim's publishing house. And there really is a lot of affinity. I'm just segueing because Stephen, a lot of what he's describing are like best in class DevOps practices. There we go. There's the four. We have a real affinity with, and very complementary to DevOps practices that are out there. I think there's a big platform engineering movement that has spun up, which, you know, we've got really good examples and instruction on how to build high performing technology organizations to deliver digital capabilities. I think where the gap we're trying to fill is really tying that back to the business strategy. And, you know, because you can build a really high performing technology organization, but it's got to be building the right stuff. And, you know, that doesn't mean just take orders from the business on what the corporate strategy is and aim for that X marks the spot, right? This is really about, how does a technology organization blend with the business organization to say, look, we're not just coming this out of architectural purity and saying, you know, decompose things into microservices or APIs or whatever. There's actual economic theory behind this and proof points with all these case studies to say optionality matters and here's an approach to take. So I think, you know, all the lessons you may learn in team topologies around organizational structures and Accelerate and, you know, DevOps handbook, like all that is very complementary to what we're doing, but really it's kind of putting a little bit of business meat on the bone around, let's dig into the business strategy and show some techniques that add value there.
Eric, if I have 30 more seconds here, We picked up a really nice nugget from another IT Red book, Project to Product by Mick Kirsten. Right. And he said it so well. You know, transformation done without for technology objectives is doomed to fail at the start. That grounding your transformation efforts in a business goal and a business outcome, that's the only way to be sustainably successful. And that drove a lot of our thinking for how to put the financial grounding in, making sure we were talking in terms of business teams could understand. Like, a big goal of ours was not to make this something that only tech nerds could read, but to make it something that more business nerds could read and really give value out of.
Kind of a mix of both, yeah. But no, I think you really hit that spot very well. But I have one last question, because you mentioned this one, which also is a great book. And in here, and you also mentioned that term, right, platform engineering. So platform engineering is really dear to my heart. I think that's one of the things that is really, really interesting that has grown tremendously in the last 2 years. And when I was reading your book, I was wondering, is that something that should also inform like how, what we built into the platform? Because what you said, Stephen, was also that, you know, you need, for example, these kind of measurement things, right? You need to gather the data so that you can interpret that. So that, I would say, then should be something that everybody should be doing by default, because you need that information. And then that, I think, in that idea of platform engineering would get pushed down into the platform. Is that something that you see a lot, or that you would recommend people do, you know, to, when you think about what should my platform be, to also say your platform should support optionality? Or am I just like taking things a little bit too far here?
No, I think we had a little bit of a discussion around the term platform. You'll see parts of the book, I think maybe in chapter one, even, where we're talking about platform approach. It was interesting that a number of people we interviewed, in the business terms, like business as a platform is kind of how you can explain APIs to business people. But that's different than, I think, platform engineering as a movement, which I think has its own biases, to me is very focused on empowering developers to build solutions, right? So it's kind of like developer platform engineering. The short answer for me would be, I feel like we need to burst through that bubble a little bit around platform engineering as a movement and think about, look, all these API options you have are part of the platform. They may not be the things you're focusing on in platform engineering, but like, yes, you can have workbenches for developer to build code and have reusable, you know, technical services, identity management, like whatever it is. But you should really be thinking about these business capabilities as part of the overall platform. And I think a lot of organizations aren't at that point yet. They're a little too much focused in the bias around developers. And I think that for organizations that are going to scale to meet the demands of, you know, 2020 development in 2025, whatever that is going to look like, you've got to have that. And we made it this far without mentioning AI. And I hate to say it, but as we go through this transformative period of moving into, you know, AI being in the mix, even if you look at how AI agents are being built or AI applications, right, they're being built with these tools that are effectively API enabled options. So once again, the companies that have the optionality around their digital capabilities are going to be able to take much more advantage of the whole AI space. So again, I think it's going to disrupt the whole platform engineering movement as much, but again, it becomes this big blended together thing. I think you should look at your overall IT estate or digital estate as this set of capabilities and think about the whole thing as a platform, not just maybe what you're focusing on your developer platform.
Thanks a lot for saying that.
Sorry, Eric. If I could add one last thing to that. Like, we saw something I think you're hinting at, like in the very last stages, we're like, uh-oh, what does this mean for team topologies? What does this mean for developer experience being the optimal thing, you know, to focus on? And we went back in, like, we brought all these concerns back to David Rice, one of the main, you know, interview subjects. And he laid it out so clearly for us in terms of, and Matt hinted at it a second ago when he talked about business as a platform or platform as the business, in that if you're trying to do these things well in advance of your business teams understanding what that is and even seeing the platform as the business, you are by definition doing something unsustainable. It just will, like, you may get marginal wins right now, But because people are so ignorant in their jobs and leadership changes happen, disruption happens, all these things happen, almost all of the advantage that you gain will be lost in when the organization reconfigures itself, when the reaction to disruption starts to carve stuff out. Because it'll be seen just like you said it, not revenue add, kill. Not revenue add, kill. And it will always be like, and the people who are making those decisions, those are not the detailed architects who know. And even if the architects are in the room, they're grounded and fit for purpose. And they see the cost center, you know, mindset in those decisions, and they will keep doing the same until the wider group of people see the platform as the business or as the lever. It's going to be cut. And placing your bets, your teams and your capabilities closer to the point of revenue generation is the only way to insulate yourself from that universe. Because efficiency is great, but it's not the end goal.
That these are the perfect closing words. Efficiency is great, but it's not the end goal, because you can do very pointless things in a highly efficient way, which doesn't help much. Thanks so much for joining Matt and Steven. That was a great conversation. Once again, read this book. It's really great. And it's also something that you can very nicely recommend to your business friends. It's not a tech book. It's really about embracing that style of thinking and that way of exploring the landscape that is out there to find those hidden treasures. So thanks, Matt and Steven.
Thank you, Eric.
And thanks everybody for joining. I hope you enjoyed this, and we're done for today. Bye everybody, and see you soon in the next GoTo Book Club. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.